This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
I want to move on now, as you see in the outline, to Friedrich Nietzsche, who barely makes it into the 20th century. 1900 was his death, although when he died, he was demented from, some scholars say, from the effects of syphilis, a sexually transmitted disease. Some people think that he went mad because his philosophy made him mad. I don't think that we can presume that that happened. There are a lot of people whose philosophies are quite maddening that don't die from mental disease. But anyway, Nietzsche is a very important figure. And like Kierkegaard, Nietzsche is primarily influential upon 20th century existentialism and some types of 20th century theology. Now you may wonder how that's true because Nietzsche was a militant atheist, but there are some 20th century theologians that give a lot of credit to Nietzsche. So, and Nietzsche's just such a tremendously interesting person. There are some people that are just fun to read, whether you agree with them or not, and Nietzsche is one of them. I think he's more fun to read, really, than Kierkegaard. Of course, Kierkegaard is exciting in his own way, but sometimes you feel that he's just going on and on and on, not going anywhere. With Nietzsche, there's a kind of clipped quality to his prose, a kind of conciseness, a kind of ability to sum up an awful lot in a short space. So Nietzsche is fun to read, although maddening if you're a Christian trying to make something out of him. Well, Nietzsche is a classical scholar. He wrote books on Greek tragedy and various things, but eventually he became known for his more philosophical work. Capital A on your outline, nihilism. Nihilism is the belief that there really is nothing that you can grasp hold of. There's nothing to trust. There's nothing that you can confidently say is real. You're just in a world of nothing. And this was Nietzsche's evaluation of what had happened up to his time. Kant had destroyed traditional metaphysics. Kant had shown us that there is no way to know the world in itself. And Nietzsche agrees with that. But Kant thought at least there were these universal a priori categories that the mind imposed on reality. And they're the same for everybody. My a priori categories are the same as yours, if you're a rational person anyway. Nietzsche said no. There are no universal a priori categories. We don't even share, see, Kant had denied metaphysics, but he had affirmed epistemology. Nietzsche denies metaphysics and he denies epistemology too, essentially. And he denies religion. Religion has lost its power in modern culture. God has died, all right, very famous saying of Nietzsche, the death of God. And by the death of God, he means essentially, he's not saying that he has news that God has actually died, but he says modern people have reached a point of sophistication where they no longer have any use for God. They don't see any point in God. They don't see any reason to worship or attend church or study the Bible, study theology. They've just outgrown God. They have no need for God. Now, Schopenhauer, another philosopher in the 19th century that we won't be looking at in this course, but Schopenhauer had a very similar diagnosis of the situation, and his response was pessimism. You just can't trust anybody. You can't believe in anything. Nietzsche is looking for a life-affirming alternative. Nietzsche is looking for something to be happy about, something to be excited about. His response to nihilism, is that we need a transvaluation of all values. Change all your values, all your evaluations. You think that the death of God is a tragedy? No, accept joyfully the death of God and the freedom that it gives us, all right? We're not bound to God's law anymore. We're not bound to include God in our understanding of the world. We can accept a naturalistic, evolutionary understanding of the world. We can reject moral and religious principles that restrict the full expression of our will to power. Christianity, he says, is a slave morality. It's a morality that the slaves thought up to try to keep them, try to bring down their masters, to try to equalize themselves and their masters. Nietzsche rejects that. He says Christianity has prevented the development of masters. Christianity has prevented the development of really superior people. So we should encourage people to not be constrained by moral principles. Rise up and take your power. Rise up and do everything that you can possibly do to extend yourself, to get benefits for yourselves. And that's called the will to power. You should aspire to be an Ubermensch, which used to be translated Superman until the cartoon character caught up with him. So there's one translator, a philosophy professor of mine, who translated it to Overman, but that's kind of awkward. So think of this person as a person who's above the other person, somebody who's a great man, who rises above the herd through superior creativity. Now, I said that Nietzsche rejected epistemology, but the way he rejects epistemology is kind of interesting. So let's look at his essay called On Truth and Lies in a Non-Moral Sense. A lot of people say that epistemology is a branch of ethics, and epistemology is something that we ought to believe, finding things that we ought to believe. So epistemology and ethics go together, and I think that's right. I think that's part of Christian epistemology too. But Nietzsche doesn't go along with that. In fact, Nietzsche doesn't think that there's anything that we need to or that we ought to believe. He says when people claim knowledge, that's a fiction. Nobody knows anything, really, the way people use the word knowledge. And it's a fiction. It's a way of feeding human pride. The intellect is a tool to secure our own interests. The intellect is a tool of the will to power. The intellect is a way of getting your way in the world and to get along with the crowd. People talk about scholarly disinterestedness, being objective. There's no such thing, says Nietzsche. The desire for truth is never disinterested. It's basically just a desire for a pleasant life. Nobody really has an interest in knowledge for the sake of knowledge. We ought to be honest about that, he says. What about language? Well, language, a word, he says, is just a copy in sound of a nerve stimulus. And We like to think sometimes that when somebody is talking to us and we hear a word, that word tells us something about the world outside us, that word is a clue to the world, that word brings us knowledge. No, it's just an experience that we have, and we've no idea what causes that experience. We don't know where the stimulus comes from. We don't know whether it comes from outside ourselves or whether it comes from inside ourselves or where it comes from. So language is very problematic, according to Nietzsche. Furthermore, language is essentially metaphorical. You take one word and apply it to many things that are very, very different. You use the word man for a human being. You also use it for a chess piece. You use the same word for a lot of different things. Well, this would not be a surprise to Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas argued that language, at least language about God, is analogical, essentially. Nietzsche is, but Aquinas at least said that some language is not analogical. Nietzsche is saying all language is essentially metaphorical, applying similar words, the same word, to different things. So we don't really know what any word refers to. We don't know what any word is saying to us. Logic, even logic is the same. It's a kind of prison. And Nietzsche says if we were different kinds of beings, we would use different logics. At best, he thinks there's an aesthetic relationship between the subject and the object, between the idea and the world, between language and reality. So we're kind of lost in a world of illusions. We don't know what's right. But, says Nietzsche, that's okay. Illusions are not always bad. Sometimes illusions are more pleasant than what people call the real world. So we ought to use our imagination self-consciously to create metaphors, to create pleasant illusions, to enhance the quality of life. Now, there's a book that Nietzsche wrote called The Cheerful Science. Used to be translated The Gay Science, but of course you can't call it that anymore. In this book, Nietzsche says, and again, I'm speaking in the field of epistemology, he says, we have organs for smell. You know, the nose is the organ for smell. The eyes are the organ for seeing. But what is the organ for knowledge? Okay, there isn't any, he says. There is no organ for truth. When we see things and when we smell things, we do some thinking and we come up with things that we think are true, but we don't know. I mean, when we're looking with our eyes, we know what we see, we know what we smell, but we don't know what's true. There is no organ for that. We know, in quotes, or believe or imagine just as much as may be useful in the interest of the human herd, the species. Even what is called utility is also a mere belief, something that's imaginary and perhaps precisely the most calamitous stupidity of which we will perish someday. Here Nietzsche is what is sometimes called a pragmatist. A pragmatist is somebody who says the truth is what works. The truth is what's useful, all right? Nietzsche's kind of like that. Nietzsche says that knowledge doesn't give us, you know, kind of objective bedrock truth, but it helps us to accomplish certain purposes. Now he's reminding us, don't be careful even of that, you know, because even utility, even pragmatics, that's not an objective concept either. So you don't know. I mean, that may be merely imaginary. You might say that believing something is useful, but it may turn out not to be useful in the final analysis. So he's more radical than the pragmatists, more radical than the Greek sophists, which are similar. So he comes up with something called perspectivism. Now, make sure that you don't confuse perspectivism with perspectivalism. Okay. Perspectivalism is Frame's idea, with all the triangles where every point of the triangle is a perspective on the rest of the triangle. That's what I call perspectivalism. Nietzsche has a somewhat different concept, although there's some similarities, which he calls perspectivism, and that is the view that there are no facts, okay? No such thing as a fact. Usually when we say this is a fact, we mean this is sure, this is certain, this is something I know. For Nietzsche, there are no facts. There are only interpretations, which Nietzsche thinks is a more modest concept. Does this mean that we have that this is self-refuting? I mean, an interpretation, do we know even that those are right? Well, at least interpretations are not necessarily false, he says. Nietzsche acknowledges the truth of specific facts when you get right down to it. I mean, you might ask Nietzsche, do you mean that you know, you're not even sure that the sun is going to rise tomorrow? Do you mean that you don't know whether you're going to have lunch today? Nietzsche's answer is, well, I know these little facts. I know these kind of everyday facts, but not general theories, the big theories, theism and pantheism and idealism and monism and dualism and pluralism, all these philosophical ideas about the universe as a whole. Those are just not plausible anymore. And he says assertions can be compared with one another in particular situations, but there are no criteria that are applicable to all situations, and so irresoluble disagreement is a fundamental fact of human life. Now, Nietzsche's work is influential, as I say, on existentialism, which we'll talk about later. It's also, I think, almost a dead ringer for what we call postmodernism or deconstructionism today. Now, I want to say more about that later in the course, but if you know anything about that, and if you've been to college, you probably do know something about that. Nietzsche is one of these people who says, okay, you know, we can believe in individual, everyday facts, what the postmodernists call the little narratives, but not the big theories, what the postmodernists would call the grand récit, or the big narrative, the meta-narrative. Like the postmodernists, Nietzsche gets here by kind of a relativistic view of language, by kind of skepticism, general skepticism about knowledge, at least knowledge of the general structure of the world, and also a kind of playfulness about it all. I mean, Nietzsche is not tragic about our loss of meaning, our loss of confidence. Postmodernists, often rather playful, as in Derrida, for example, often rather playful about the way they juggle words together, and they ask hard questions of their students and so on and so forth. Well, that's just a little look into the future. Nietzsche really is way ahead of his time, as I think Kierkegaard is way ahead of his time. And so these two figures give you a kind of approach to the future. Now I want to talk about an American movement, American pragmatism. And as I mentioned, Nietzsche is a little bit pragmatic, although he says he wants to be more than pragmatic. But I want to get carry out that theme a little bit and see what real pragmatism is. Actually, there are several forms of it that we'll look at. The first form is the pragmatism of Charles Sanders Peirce. Pronounce it Peirce, not Pierce. And I think I spelled him wrong there, too. I think his name is P-E-I-R-C-E, not P-I-E-R. So I'll say Charles Sanders Peirce, and you see his dates there. His background is in science rather than philosophy. He has a degree in chemistry, worked as a scientist for the U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey for 30 years, but became more and more interested in the problems of philosophy and mathematics through that period. In 1887, he retired to Milford, PA, to work on philosophy, and he lectured on philosophy at various universities, and I think he would have wanted to get a position at a university teaching philosophy, but he wasn't able to find a permanent job in that field. He befriended William James, who we'll talk about a little bit later, and James evidently provided some of his financial assistance for part of his life, but he never actually had a teaching job in the area of philosophy, although today he's remembered as a very important, very significant philosopher. He starts off in opposition to Descartes. Descartes said we should doubt everything, or doubt everything that it's possible to doubt. And then we settle in on the one thing we can't doubt, which is our own existence. I think, therefore I am. Peirce says that's the wrong way to go. Don't start off trying to doubt everything. Begin only with the things that you really doubt. And the things that, and these are always things that you're trying to resolve. If you have real doubt about something, then you probably have in mind a procedure by which you can resolve that doubt. And that's the only genuine doubt there is. If I stand here before you and I say, I doubt that I have five fingers, well, the question is, how would you resolve that doubt? I mean, it's not a meaningful doubt, Peirce would say. Although some philosophers would question that, but Peirce would say that's not a real doubt because there's no procedure by which to resolve it. And he says that if you doubt only methodologically, Descartes' doubt is sometimes called methodological doubt. Descartes has a method where you doubt everything at the beginning of your philosophical thinking and then try to reinstate these things that you doubted by arguments. Peirce says if you doubt only methodologically, then you may be only too hasty to reinstate those beliefs that you really didn't doubt. I mean, you didn't really doubt them, and you're trying to find a way to reinforce them and get them back into the realm of knowledge. Also, Peirce supposes Descartes' tendency to rest ultimate certainty in the individual consciousness. He disagrees with Descartes' epistemological individualism. He says that in real reasoning, and he's trying to say, how do we really reason? You know, how do we really get the truth? How do we really resolve problems? And he says, and this typical scientist, he says, we resolve our problems in community, you know, in discussion. You know, you do your experiment, and I'll do my experiment, and we'll hope that they all come together. So there's a community operating in order to resolve doubts. If you doubt that there's such a thing as a Higgs boson, well, you talk to your fellow scientists, and they concoct an experiment, and they analyze it together, and they do the calculations, and one of them says, I calculated this, and the other says, no, that's not right, I calculated that, and then the third one says, oh, I agree with Bill, his calculations, and I don't agree with Sam, and eventually there's a consensus that comes up. Don't rest ultimate certainty on your individual consciousness, as Descartes did. Descartes, you know, came up with his reasoning as a purely individual matter. Number three, don't do what Descartes did, resting all knowledge on a single thread of evidence. Better to use many mutually reinforcing arguments like threads of a cable. Not just one argument, I think, therefore I am, therefore God exists because he's, we need somebody big enough to create me, and on you go. You want to come up with a whole lot of different experiments, a whole lot of different arguments. And again, it's kind of a more scientific mentality that the Peirce represents. Four, Descartes supposed that some things are inexplicable apart from God, and therefore God must exist. Well, Peirce says you never have the right to assume that. You never have the right to assume that anything is inexplicable. You never know. Tomorrow you may find an explanation for something that you said today was inexplicable. And then number five, in an article called The Fixation of Belief, we should not try to base our cognition on absolutely certain propositions. Rather, we should simply base our thinking on propositions that are free from actual doubt. And of course, we may come later on to see that those propositions are no longer tenable, but that's okay. I mean, we may have to revise the things that we think we know. And that's okay. Don't worry about coming up with something that's absolutely firm and can never be revised. Don't go seeking absolute certainty the way Descartes did, find out what do we know? What is it that we have no actual doubts about? And then work out your system from there. You may have to go back to the beginning and change something that you thought that you knew, but that's just the way it is. That's the way science is, and that's the way knowledge is. So you see, Peirce is one of the first philosophers to put a huge emphasis on scientific method. And basically, he thinks that scientific method is the way to knowledge. It's the way to truth. There's a book called The Fixation of Belief, I mentioned briefly, where Peirce examines the psychology of belief formation. This is what I sometimes call the existential perspective. How is it that I move from a state of doubt to a state of belief? Now, he says that beliefs are objectively true or false, but whether we believe something, that's a subjective thing. Whether we believe something depends on how it guides our actions. A belief, he says, is that which a man is prepared to act upon. This is kind of a pragmatic understanding of belief. Peirce has sometimes been called a pragmatist. I'll talk about that in a minute. Belief is what a person is prepared to act upon. Doubt is an uneasy state of mind. Belief is a corresponding calm, a satisfaction. In my book, Doctrine of the Knowledge of God, I make use of this idea, saying that to know something involves a feeling of rest, a feeling of calm, a feeling that your task is completed, and I call it cognitive rest. But there's a kind of struggle here psychologically to move from doubt to belief, and that struggle to move from doubt to belief is called inquiry. Now, when you have an idea, how is it that you can come to ideas that you're confident about? In other words, how do you fixate your ideas? And Peirce lists several possibilities. One is what he calls the method of tenacity. These are all kind of tongue-in-cheek, of course. The method of tenacity is to hold your present beliefs against all challenge. We all know people in Presbyterian circles that are like that, don't we? Hold your present beliefs against all challenge. Second method is the method of authority, that is, accept all the beliefs that are imposed by society or by the state or by the church. Then C, there's the a priori method, which is to believe what you're inclined to believe, what looks good to you. He says this is sort of an aesthetic approach. Plato, for example, believed that the distances of the celestial spheres to one another, and remember Plato spent some time with the Pythagoreans. Pythagoreans had discovered the Pythagorean theorem, that in a triangle, the square of the sides, the sum of the square of the sides is equal to the square of the hypotenuse. So they were, the Pythagoreans thought that there are all these kind of interesting number phenomena throughout the universe, and you can sort of understand the world by reducing it to numbers and all. And Plato held to this Greek notion of the universe as concentric spheres, the universe we live in here in the middle, and then the outer sphere, and eventually you get to the moon and stars and so on and so forth. And he thought from the Pythagoreans that there were definite ratios in the numbers that kept these spheres from one another. Now, the Pythagoreans had discovered that strings vibrate at certain rates depending on the notes, musical notes, or the musical notes depended on the number of vibrations, so that if you play an A on the piano, and I know they didn't have pianos then, but the A registers 440 vibrations per second, and then if you double that and make it 880, then you hear the A an octave higher. So there are definite ratios between the musical notes and the vibrations. Plato thought that the distance between the spheres was proportional to the different lengths of strings that produce chords. Hegel thought that every natural tendency of thought is logical. It can kind of be reduced to this thesis, synthesis, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. But Peirce says that's not reliable. I mean, you don't know. Plato never saw the celestial spheres. Hegel doesn't know for sure, although he thinks he knows for sure. Hegel doesn't know for sure that all human reasoning can be reduced to this dialectical process. So that's a wrong way of trying to gain knowledge, this a priori, that you presuppose a pattern and then expect all knowledge to fulfill that pattern. No, the real way to gain knowledge is... And here we expect a drum roll. We almost know what Peirce is going to say. The real way to gain knowledge is through science, a scientific method. And he calls this critical common sensism. This is inquiry guided by common sense certainties. So remember Thomas Reed and common sense. Inquiry guided by common sense certainties, which are fallible. So you start with your common sense, and you move on from there. You do various kinds of reasoning. There is abduction or retroduction, which is forming a relevant hypothesis by that will yield some knowledge. If this happens, then say I want to know whether there is a Higgs boson. Well, if there is, then this should result. So that's the hypothesis. And then deduction would be determining the consequences. If there's a Higgs boson, then this ought to happen, and this ought to happen. And then induction is actually testing the hypothesis by its practical effects. So that would be the experiment that they're running in Europe to determine whether there's a Higgs boson or not. So those three steps are part of the scientific method. Peirce says this is the way all knowledge ought to proceed, you know. If you want to say that you know something, you've got to be willing to go through those kinds of scientific steps. Another essay of Peirce is called How to Make Our Ideas Clear, especially in formulating hypotheses. Descartes said you can't believe anything for sure unless it's clearly and distinctly perceived. But Peirce says you have to add to these criteria, not only clarity and distinctness, but also practical consequences. And if you want to know how two ideas differ, they may look the same, but if you want to know how they differ insofar as they entail different practical consequences. So one scientist says, yes, there are Higgs bosons. The other scientist says, no, there isn't. Well, what is the difference between these two positions? The difference is this one has these consequences. This one has these consequences, which are different. This brings us to pragmatism. Peirce defines what he calls the pragmatic maxim. That is, in order to ascertain the meaning of an intellectual conception, we should consider what practical consequences might conceivably result from the truth of that conception. And the sum of these consequences will constitute the entire meaning of that conception. That's Peirce's pragmatism. To understand the meaning of a concept, you try to understand the practical consequences of that concept, of that idea. William James and John Dewey went beyond this to talk about a pragmatic theory of truth. Now remember, with Peirce, pragmatism is mainly a theory of meaning. With Peirce, you ask the practical consequences of something in order to understand what it means. If you say, I believe in one God, what does that mean practically, okay? What is the world going to be like if there's one God as opposed to there being many gods or being no gods? So you test out the practical consequences in order to tell what is meant by one God. Now, William James, who was impressed by Peirce and who supported him financially, William James came along with what he called the pragmatic theory of truth. That is, the truth is what works. Peirce didn't agree with James. Peirce thought pragmatism is really a theory about meaning, not a theory about truth. Truth is objective for Peirce. Truth has nothing to do with whether it's useful for us or not. Is it useful to believe in God or isn't it? Well, that doesn't matter, says Peirce. But the meaning of belief in God can be tested pragmatically. But the truth of whether God exists cannot be treated pragmatically. It has to be treated experimentally. So Peirce and James differed with that. Peirce repudiated the pragmatic theory of truth. To him, the truth is objective, independent of our thoughts or aspirations. He redefined his own position as pragmaticism. He says, okay, if James is going to hijack the word pragmatism, he says, I will describe my own position by the word pragmaticism, and he says that term is ugly enough to keep it from kidnappers. Well, there are other kind of interesting things that Peirce developed. One is called phenomenology. And the term phenomenology later was used for a whole school of thought, which we'll talk about eventually. Peirce says, phenomenology is the examination of the phenomena of experience. That is, what does experience display to us? Remember how Kant used the term phenomena. What are the appearances of things? And for Peirce, there are three categories here. Firstness, secondness, and thirdness. All right. First would be the qualities, like color, shape, and so on. Secondly, the brute facticity of something. Now, in traditional philosophy, qualities attach to substances, all right? The tree is green, and the tree is hard, and the tree is large. Those qualities, though, are qualities of the tree. The tree is the substance. The tree is the reality. The tree is the fact. In Greek thought, this is the difference between forms and matter. The forms are the qualities. The matter is what the forms attach to, or more accurately, perhaps, the substance, which is both form and matter. The substance is what the forms attach to. But Peirce reproduces these discussions. Firstness is essentially form. Secondness is essentially matter or substance. And then thirdness are the laws of nature, all right? And I've kind of identified these in my outline as firstness being existential, secondness being situational, and thirdness being normative. But these are kind of similar to the universals and the particulars of the Greeks. Well, this is all very interesting, and Peirce anticipates a lot to come in William James's Pragmatism, but also in Phenomenology, and there's a lot here, a lot of Wittgenstein here. Wittgenstein later was to say, don't engage in theoretical doubts, only engage in real doubts. That's Wittgenstein, and he's holds the same view as Peirce. I don't know if he read Peirce or not. So Peirce kind of leads the way to a lot of developments. And Peirce is perhaps the most important mind in 20th century American philosophy. Now, Americans have not been known as philosophers. There is Jonathan Edwards, which I certainly should be including in this course, but I don't know quite how to do him. I mean, he's partly just an Orthodox Calvinist, and he's partly there are a few things in Edwards that are a little bit strange and weird, and I don't know quite how to, I don't want to spend class time on the weirdnesses, and I don't want to spend class time just telling you how Orthodox Edwards was, so I don't know how to work him into this particular course. But anyway, Peirce is somebody who is engaged in the history of philosophy. He does have disciples, and he does introduce new ideas that are taken seriously by later generations. And so he begins a tradition of American philosophy. Wouldn't you guess that the first main school of American philosophy is pragmatism? This is what Americans are supposedly known for. We care about what works, right? We care about we care about the results of things, right? We don't think too much about the principles or the morality or the philosophy. We care about the product. In that sense, Peirce is quintessentially American, although James is even more so. I mean, Peirce had a pragmatic view of meaning. James now has a pragmatic view of truth. Well, here's William James at the bottom of 87, Roman numeral 3. He has a medical degree from Harvard, and he taught anatomy there and physiology for a while. Then he entered into the rather new science of psychology, and from there he went on to philosophy. His main work of psychology is a volume called The Varieties of Religious Experience, where he made a study of a lot of people who thought they had experience of God, and he goes through all these cases and talks about what they have in common and how they're different, and what they suppose, and is there a concept of God that might explain all these religious experiences. And he comes to the conclusion that it's kind of a finite God, that that's all you need to have. But that's an example of his work in psychology. He became eventually more famous as a philosopher. William James is the brother of the novelist Henry James. William was very, very clear writer. People sometimes said it would have been better if William had wrote the novels and if Henry had been the philosopher, but that was not to be. I'm sure that Henry was a more subtle mind and more more appropriate for him to write novels than for William. But William is, if you find Henry leading you into a swamp and you'd like a refreshment from that, go and read some of William James. But anyway, William there's some interesting things about him. Epistemology, he points out that emotions and will are important in gaining knowledge. Knowledge is not just a matter of the intellect as an abstraction. He's a radical empiricist, that is to say, everything that we know is experience, whether it comes from outside us or within us. Pragmatism. Now, James does accept the truth, the idea of truth, in the conventional sense, as something that something that is objective, something that is the truth no matter what we think about it. But James is concerned about the way we can, how can we identify truth given our fallibility. And he says that the ideas that we consider to be true, the ideas that we identify as truth, and we say, yeah, I know that's the truth, these are the ideas that work. These are the ideas that lead somewhere. These are the ideas that don't mislead us, and we can count on them. And so they have cash value. You see, he uses all these terms to indicate something that is pragmatically useful. True ideas are ideas that succeed. And so they're getting to know the truth is a process. Truth is not something stagnant. It's not something static. It's not that you have these pictures in your mind that kind of agree with or copy things out there like a photograph. Rather, gaining knowledge is not like photographing things. Gaining knowledge is trying one thing out and then something else and seeing, this one is successful and this one is not successful. It's very, very dynamic. By the way, that's kind of characteristic of 20th century philosophy and theology. People always prefer dynamic categories to static categories. So remember if you're going to come up with a new idea, show how it's static. And so, no, don't show how it's static. Show how it's dynamic rather than static. James's philosophy of religion, he wrote a book, Varieties of Religious Experience, arguing that a finite God is all that we need to account for our religious experience. The other thing that that he wrote that's very, by the way, he also wrote Defending Libertarian Free Will, but probably his most famous writing on the philosophy of religion is called The Will to Believe. It's an article which is a reworking of Pascal's Wager. And he says that Pascal's Wager won't work for proving just anything, but sometimes we're faced with a question where we have to answer it immediately. Our choice is forced and our choice is momentous. And it's important that we come to a conclusion right now. We don't have time to go through experiments. We don't have time to go through a lengthy discussion, a lengthy calculation. We just have to make up our mind real quick in the midst of a crisis moment. And religion is like this, you know, now is the acceptable day, now is the day of salvation. James says that Pascal was right, that in situations like that at least, we do have the right to take prudence into it, to reason according to what the odds are, what's likely to happen if I make this choice, what's likely to happen if I make that choice. And we have the right then to believe something without normal standards of evidence. And so Pascal's wager is an appropriate way of resolving the question of belief in God. Okay, that's American pragmatism. The third pragmatist, you know, all these schools of thought have three representatives typically, which is kind of interesting. With pragmatism, it's Peirce, James, and Dewey. I say a lot about Dewey in my ethics book, talking about Dewey's ethics. And Dewey is also a very important figure in developing public education of the United States. And I think his influence there is very bad. Dewey is interesting, very sharp thinker. He points out that our thinking is constantly in process. We never reach a point where we can just sit down and say, okay, now I know, now this is for sure, because our the things we do, our projects are constantly changing, our goals are changing, our means are changing, our experiments are changing. You may start with one experiment and then decide that the way it's moving, you would be better to do a different experiment. And so things are just constantly kind of in flux. And I think that sort of reduces pragmatism to a form of irrationality, but you can do your own research on Dewey.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.